Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Coming up on episode 342 of Wheel Bearings, we've got the Honda Passport Trail Sport, the new Lincoln Nautilus, a hybrid Porsche 911 is coming this summer. Polestar has already dropped the price of the Polestar 3 by $10,000 before it even goes on sale. The passing of Marcello Gandini, data from connected cars, subscriptions for the Audi A3, some more looks at the Tesla Cybertruck, and Rivians can now supercharge. All that and more coming up next. This is episode 342 of Wheel Bearings. I'm Sam Abuel-Samad from Guidehouse Insights.
And I am Roberto Baldwin from SAE International.
And sadly, Nicole is not feeling well today. She's sick in bed with a nasty cold and can't really talk. So we're going to let her off the hook this time. But in the show notes, you will find a link to the video that Nicole and I recorded with the Lincoln Nautilus during our drive. And so after you're done listening to this, you can go watch that and get your fix of Nicole. So yeah. What have you been driving?
So this week I have been driving the Ford Escape plug-in hybrid. It's actually the big long name. The 2023 Escape Titanium plug-in hybrid front-wheel drive. It's like, Titanium front-wheel drive. You're like,
Unfortunately, Ford doesn't offer the Escape plug-in hybrid with all-wheel drive. You can only get it with front drive. The regular hybrid you can get with all-wheel drive, but not the plug-in.
It's, you know, because the plug takes up all that extra space.
Well, I mean, it is actually the battery, because the battery's
larger.
Spans across the whole width under the back seat. And so if you want an Escape plug-in hybrid with all-wheel drive, Lincoln's got you covered with the Corsair Grand Touring. Because they put an electric motor on the rear axle.
What's fun is that they can make a plug-in hybrid Maverick if they really wanted to. Just saying.
They could.
And it's the same. Everything's on top of the Escape platform. And there's like, oh, we could have a plug-in hybrid Maverick.
And
it would still only be front-wheel drive.
I was talking to some folks from Ford earlier this week when we were out driving the new Ranger, and we'll talk about that next week when the embargo lifts. But you know, it sounds like they've got more Maverick variants coming, including at the very least a hybrid all-wheel drive. The plug-in probably as well.
Hybrid all-wheel drive, that's the jam.
Yep.
Because it's probably going to be hybrid is. Was it all-wheel drive like 50? I'm not going to look up the thing. Anyway, back to the Ford Escape. from which all these things are born from, the Ford Escape. So, yeah, driving the 2023 plug-in hybrid, front-wheel drive, Ford Escape, the titanium, which makes it probably more expensive than it needs to be honest. If you're a huge Escape fan, then fine, go crazy, get the fancy seats with the stitching and all the additional fun little things, panoramic vista roof, the premium package for the PHEV, heads-up display, which isn't, it's one of those little
Just
the little
the flip up glass panel on top of the dash.
The flip up glass panel on top of the dash, which if it doesn't go up, if it doesn't angle itself enough, if you're tall, what happens is that you have to adjust your vision on the head-up display. So now everything is on the hood of the car. So because I'm tall and because the glass is, the glass, it can't, they've set it at, whatever angle. I'm assuming 90 degrees. And so when I, in order to adjust the actual display itself, it's now at the edge of the roof is the speed and the ADAS information and lane keep assist, et cetera, which, yeah, fine. It's not that big of a deal, but it doesn't feel, it feels kind of like, especially when you're driving something called the titanium. I think that's where it sort of gets lost. Yeah, this vehicle has the best part about this vehicle is that it's a PHEV plug-in hybrid. You can plug it in, wait all night, get up the next day, and drive up to 37 miles. 37 miles of EV only range. I didn't quite get that during my drive. I wasn't able to do a like we're recording on Saturday. Saturday is the day I test cars, so I wasn't able to do the test, but it wasn't def it was not hitting 37 miles of EV only range in my just kind of like plugging it in and then driving it around all day. So you're it may your use may vary. What's interesting though is when I drive 40 EVs, those things are boom right on the dot. Whatever the EV says, whatever the EPA number is, it's like boop right on the dot for my test. So yeah, I think maybe it's not cold. It's not, it's been actually really nice, but it has been crazy windy. So maybe that's when you're driving, when trees are falling over, maybe driving into a headwind will do that to your car. The MPG just cruising around. It says 40. I've been getting like 47, so that's great. If you're just driving around, like some days because my wife has an EV, and so some of the days I didn't charge it and I'm still driving it around, even though the battery is officially depleted. And, it's still adding energy to the battery via the engine and via regenerative braking. And I'm getting 47 miles per gallon. So that right there's like, even if you don't plug it in, like, and you should because you're going to save so much more money, I'm still getting really, really good gas mileage out of this vehicle. So kudos to Ford for that. It's front-wheel drive, like Sam was saying. If you want all-wheel drive, you can't get the plug-in, so that's sort of a bummer. Hopefully they'll change that, but it's front-wheel drive. I think for most people is fine. I think a lot of us are really, everything's all-wheel drive now, so because of that, we're expecting, well, everything to be all-wheel drive. It's not that big of a deal. It does have USB A and C plugs, which is nice. So if you're that type of person who's, maybe they have an old i they have an iPhone that doesn't have USB-C, and then a regular, and then a new iPhone, or if you have a Android, or if you just want to plug other things in, whatever
Or
cables you got,
if you just
you're
happen to
good.
have some old, USB-A cables, you can still use them in your Escape.
Yeah, so you can still plug it in. The driving that the Escape is, it is an fine car, and that's it's not exciting. There's nothing exciting about the Escape. No one's ever like walked into the showroom and like did a fist bump, Escape, or like jumped up in the air because they just bought an Escape. They're just like, I need a car that'll get me around. I have Fords, I like Fords. Oh, the Escape, it's the right size. You can put people in the back seat. It's got some good cargo space. Fine. I'll just get an Escape. And then you just drive off and everyone forgets what kind of car you drive because it just sort of looks like everything else on the road. It's almost like an invisible car, But for a lot of people, I think that's totally fine.
Most people won't have a problem with that.
Yeah, you're fine. I just need a good car that gets me around, that gets good gas mileage. Even if I forget to charge it overnight, you're still going to get some good gas mileage. If you do charge it, and again, you should, you'll get that 37 miles of range, maybe a little less, maybe 35, 34. But according to the Department of Transportation, the average person drives 37 miles a day. So if you're an average person and you plug this thing in and you average it out, because this is a pretty average car, everything, you're going to get 37 miles. You're going to ride on the dot. You'll use a little bit of gasoline for, maybe if you decide to go, you have big hills or whatever. But yeah, it's an average car.
For the most part, if you plug it in daily, you'll be able to do all your driving as if this
Yeah.
was an EV, and then when it's time to take long trips, it won't matter because you
You're
can just
golden.
keep on going.
You keep on trucking. Well,
Yep.
not trucking. Keep on crossovering. The 2024, I got the 2023. I don't know why. The 2024 starts at $40,500. The version I got, the base price is $38,500. So if you want to save some cash, look for a 2023 in a lot, and you'll save about $1,500. But because I got the titanium, because all the automakers have insisted that we get the best of the best of every car, which, I mean, I guess it's nice. I would rather get like what their data says the average person buys, which I'm thinking is probably about middle of the road. I think, I would rather
And
get that level.
in the case of the current generation of Escape, I think that would probably be like the ST line.
Yeah.
Is kind of that's kind of the middle of the road right now for
Yeah.
the current generation.
So the middle of the road would be nice if that's what they delivered, but instead they gave me the titanium, which so at the end of the day, this vehicle is now costing you $46,815, about $8,000 more than its base price, which is, I don't feel like it has $8,000 worth of stuff that's worth paying for this, to be honest. Again,
Well, you are getting that little heads-up display.
you do to get that little heads-up display, which I guess it's fine. But yeah, no, I don't know. The top of the line, it's for something like this feels, I don't know. You could have just saved the money, because most of these things you probably won't use all that often. I mean, the heads-up display is always awesome, but it'd be better if that was on a, you could probably get that on the lower trim, maybe. Yeah, that's it. That's I really don't. It's such a like, okay, I'm gonna get in this car, I'm gonna drive it over somewhere, and then I'm gonna come back. It's just that car. It's just there. It's again, and this is no, this is not. I'm not trying to like say, oh, boo, the Escape. It's a fine vehicle, and that's exactly what it is. A fine invisible vehicle. That's what I think the Ford Escape, the plug-in hybrid, I think makes it a much better vehicle, to be honest. Just because that. Again, the 37 miles plus the MPG of about 46, 47 is what I'm getting right now. That's fantastic. So good job to Ford engineers for that.
But when you consider the fact that a regular Escape hybrid, you can get for starting closer to $30,000.
It's a big jump.
Yeah, I mean that, the $10,000 just to get from that to the plug-in hybrid, so let's see the active the Escape, base Escape active. Let's see, can you get the hybrid on that? I thought you could. You used to be able to. But the ST, oh, here we go. So the ST line with the hybrid is $33,490. And then you're looking at $7,000 more to get to the plug-in hybrid. And then with the options that were on yours, what was another $6,000 to $7,000 for that, at least for even for that $7,000, the savings you're gonna have to make up that savings in fuel economy, because you're going to get like 40 miles per gallon with that regular Escape hybrid anyway, or 40 plus miles per gallon. you're probably never going to make up that difference.
Well, here's the rub is that if you get the Escape as a lease, you can get probably like a partial credit for the tax thing. I'm just looking at maybe. This is from March 11, 2024. So yeah, so you can get like almost $6,800. So you can kind of offset that.
Yeah,
and
I don't
also
know
get
if
the
Ford
thing.
is, I don't know if Ford is doing that though. I mean, in theory, they could, you know, because it's got a big enough battery that they.
Why
they,
wouldn't they?
most
and
other
really,
auto,
I
most
feel
other
like
automakers are.
because I feel like the, and then that's really, I think that's at the dealership level. Unless the dealerships are not giving the discount, but then they, because they bought it, they get the discount. But that's how they would get the discount if they did the lease. I don't know. If you're going in, check and see what the
IRA.
I
mean, if they'll give you the IRA tax credit when you lease it, then it's a good deal, because then you're down to like close to the same price as the hybrid. And in that case, then absolutely go for the plug-in hybrid.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, you might be better off going, you know, it's the Escape plug-in hybrid's main competitor is the Toyota RAV4 Prime.
And it's about $3,000 more.
Right.
Starting.
And I believe Toyota is doing the tax credit pass through on a lease on the RAV4 Prime. So, you know, the RAV4 Prime
also
will give you,
drive.
Yeah, it gets you all-wheel drive, it's got more power. And
more range.
It's and more and a little bit more range, a few miles more range.
42, five more miles. Which if you're if you work 39, if your daily drive is 39 miles.
Well, there you go, and you're all set.
Yeah.
And get the RAV4.
So for $3,000 you get a little bit more range, you get all wheel drive, you get a Toyota RAV4, which looks cool, to be honest. It's a bit more aggressive, you know. It's still, you know, pretty much, and it's more aggressive looking. It's got sharper lines than the Escape, so more
it
people
stands
are going
out
to
a little bit more than
yeah
Escape.
It stands out just a scooch more. They're all pretty much the same, to be honest, but it stands out just a bit more.
All right, anything else on the Escape plug-in hybrid?
Nah.
All right, so I had an SUV that was not a plug-in hybrid this week. I had the Honda Pilot Trail Sport. So over the last year or two, Honda has been adding a Trail Sport trim to most of its SUVs and trucks, like the Ridgeline, and you know, this gives it a little bit more off-roady look, you know, a little more aggressive look. You know, they've got it on the Pilot, they've got it on the Ridgeline, they've got it on the Pilot now, or the Passport. You know, and the Passport, you know, is based on the previous generation of the Pilot. It's basically, it's the same wheelbase as the Pilot, but with a slightly shorter body, and it's a two row rather than a three row. And it was always, you know, from launch, it was always meant to be more the lifestyle vehicle, more outdoorsy adventure type. But, you know, it's never really been a hardcore SUV. You know, this is not something that is competing with, say, literally anything from Jeep. You know, the Trail Sport makes it a little more aggressive looking. So you get some all-terrain tires on 18-inch wheels. Let's see. It's got, I think, slightly more ground clearance than the regular ones. You know,
this is the Passport or the Pilot?
The Passport. The
okay,
because
you said you drove
Sport.
The you said you drove the Passport, then you said you drove the Pilot. So I'm confused. They're the
I'm
same
getting
car.
All
That's
confused.
The problem.
Yeah, that is the problem. Yeah. So overall, you know, they're both really good vehicles. I actually drove the Pilot Trail Sport last summer. I drove the Passport this past week.
All
so
right.
The Passport Trail Sport is the one I had. That's the two row. And so, you know, you get some more rugged looking all-terrain tires, taller sidewalls, which in and of itself is actually probably a good thing. Especially if you live somewhere like Michigan where we have terrible roads, or you're going to take it, you know, to go to a cabin or something. This is not a vehicle, despite the fact that when Honda launched the Passport like 4 or 5 years ago, you know, they did the launch drive out in Moab, and we drove it in Moab in Utah, and It did surprisingly well, even on, before it got like proper all-terrain tires. But now, it'll do a little bit better. So it's got slightly more ground clearance. Last year, they refreshed the front end, so it's got a little more upright fascia on it, so it looks a little more trucky and SUV-like. This is not intended for hardcore off-road use, but they have, the Trail Sport does get a couple of steel skid plates to protect some of the more vulnerable stuff underneath the vehicle. Like I said, the all-terrain tires, those all-terrain tires, give you a little bit of a hit on fuel economy. But overall, it's generally a pretty good package. And if you want a two-row utility that is primarily for on-road use, but kind of looks like it can go off-road a little bit, and you
can
want
go camping in it, snowboarding.
It's bigger than a CRV, or a RAV4 or an Escape. So if you want more room than what you get in those more compact utilities, then this is an interesting option for you. So the one that I had did not come with a Monroney, basically the only real option on it was the Radiant Red Metallic 2, not Radiant Red Metallic 1, but Radiant Red Metallic 2 paint.
Oh, electric boogaloo.
Yeah, which was an extra $455. Everything else is pretty much standard in here.
They have a blue that's really nice, so just save the $500.
Yeah, the diffused sky blue pearl.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, that's also $455, so it's the same price.
Oh, okay.
Only the black and the white are no extra cost.
Free.
The other, the interesting colors all cost extra. I had the red. The powertrain in here is the same 3.5 liter V6 that Honda has been using in all kinds of their stuff for like 300 years. Still a good engine, 280 horsepower. In the next generation of this, it'll probably get replaced by a turbocharged 4-cylinder engine. But for now, it still has that with a 9-speed automatic transmission. All-wheel drive comes standard on the Trail Sport, so you don't have to pay extra for that. Why did I do that? I changed the color on myself. Okay, there we go. Back to that price. So the total price as built was $46,350, which is about the same as that as the Escape that you had. This does not have a plug-in hybrid, does not get 47 miles per gallon, will not go 37 miles on a charge. It averaged about 18-19 miles per gallon during my week of driving, which is kind of mediocre. By today's standards. But aside from that, everything else about, the seats, typical of a Honda, the seats are very comfortable. The infotainment system is still Honda's older generation system, so it's not the new Android automotive system. But it's still a fairly easy to use system. The interface is fairly clean. It's relatively responsive. The voice recognition in it, though, is pretty miserable. If I tried to use voice to, put in a destination for the navigation, it had a very, very hard time finding what I was looking for. Apart from that, the rest of it worked fine. And most of the controls on here are still physical controls, which is a good thing.
Yay.
$46,350 for this. So if you're looking for sort of an upper midsize, two-row off-roady looking SUV, the Passport is probably the Passport Trail Sport's up probably worth a look. I think for most people that are considering something like this, unless you really, really feel like you need to have that kind of more off-roady look, you could probably just go with the regular Passport and save yourself quite a bit of money, because it starts, it's not that much cheap. cheaper.
It's like 3,500, 2,500?
No, yeah, it starts at 41,900 for the EXL. And now there's also a black edition, which starts at $48,000. So,
which who knows what that means?
Yeah. So actually, you know, if you're thinking about a passport, just go ahead and get the Trail Sport. Forget what I said. Just get the Trail Sport because for what you're going to save on the EXL, you're probably going to spend that on extra options anyway. So,
yeah. Boom. There you go.
So there you go.
It's like if you want a little bit nicer than a Crosstrek.
Yes.
You want all-wheel drive and you don't want to deal with a CRT.
Yeah, there you go.
Right.
CVT.
CVT. Yes. I'm like, nope, that's
well,
television.
And this is quite a bit larger than a Crosstrek as well. I mean, this is more the size of the
Ascent.
The Ascent, yes.
Yeah.
So if you want something
I've ever driven the
CVT.
Oh, I think I have driven the Ascent. Never mind.
I have not.
I think. Maybe? Oh, man, I can't remember. That's a weird thing. That Crosstrek is just their money. That's their money car.
Yeah.
Just printing dollars for the folks over at Subaru.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. All right, let's move on.
Let's pretend we know what...
What? Then we know what we're talking about.
What Nicole drove up 9/11. She loved it. The end.
I have no idea what Nicole drove. She can talk about it next week.
Yeah.
But well, actually, there is one thing I do know that Nicole drove. Because I was driving with her. We were in Palm Springs, driving the 2024 Lincoln Nautilus. So this is an all new version of the Nautilus. The Ford Edge is going away. In the past, the Nautilus has shared a platform with the Edge. And the new platform is not fundamentally different from the old platform. Still has the same basic architecture, same type of strut front suspension, integral link rear independent suspension. But, the Nautilus is a little bit bigger than before. It's also built in China now. Because the Oakville assembly plant where they built the Edge and the Nautilus previously is being retooled to build EVs starting sometime next year or late this year. So they decided to discontinue the Edge. They're bringing in the Nautilus from China where it actually sells better than it does here. That's why they're building it there. And it adopts, you know, the new design language that Lincoln's been using on their vehicles that they've launched in China and have refreshed on their vehicles here over the last year and a half or so. So the look that we see on here actually started a couple of years ago with the Lincoln Zephyr sedan in China. So you know, a little bit larger grille, uh, the the kind of signature lighting. They're doing the light bar all the way across. It goes underneath the slim headlamps and kind of have like the feather like look of the signals on the corners. And then the turn wrap around, turn down tail lights. It's a good looking premium mid-sized SUV. One of the cool things that they added to this is the same style of door handles that they had on the Continental sedan, the last generation Continental sedan. So there's a trim strip that runs along the base of the side glass, and the door handles are sort of integrated into this. So when you look at it kind of straight on from the side, the door handle, it looks like there's no door handles, but they're actually there. They just kind of swell out from that trim strip. And they work easily, you know, they're easy to grab, unlike the style of door handles that pop out of the doors. You know, these don't have to pop out. So they're never going to get stuck when there's snow or ice on them or anything like that.
I don't like the pop out door handles.
They're always too finicky.
It's finicky and it's fancy for the sake of fancy. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, we save 0.0000001 and drag efficiency. And
well, we'll get to fancy for the sake of fancy in a minute.
All right. So they moved that somewhere else.
Yeah. The exterior looks good. The interior actually looks really nice too. I mean, you know, I like what Lincoln's been doing with their interiors over the last 7, 8, 9 years. You know, it looks completely different from what you'll find in a Ford. Looks much more premium. You know, it looks like a premium vehicle. No issues there. One of the unique thing for the Nautilus, especially for North America, is it's the first application in a Ford or Lincoln vehicle of a full width, you know, what they sometimes refer to as a coast-to-coast display. So it's a 48-inch display in this thing. And it's curved. It sits further forward at the base of the windshield, so it's not a touchscreen. You don't touch this particular display. And it's actually technically not a single 48-inch display. It's actually two displays. There's a small bezel. There's about a quarter inch to a half inch of bezel in between the two segments of the display, but it's fine. You know, you're not even going to notice it. The first time we saw something like this was back in, I think, in like 2018. There was a Chinese EV startup called Byton that is now defunct, but when they showed their first concept of their first vehicle, or what was intended to be their first vehicle, the M-Byte, it had this same style of display that was pushed further forward, full width. And the idea is to have it, you know, as an alternative to a heads-up display, to have it as something that is closer to the driver's line of sight. So you have all the information up there. You know, you're not fiddling with the touchscreen as much, because you can't touch this particular display. You have more space for information like the maps and other stuff. And when we first saw it last year, there was some concerns, you know, about the passenger side of this display, because it does run all the way across in front of the passenger. And is that actually going to be distracting? And I can say, thankfully, the answer to that is no, it's not distracting. Because the way they've arranged this, this is the first vehicle Ford is launching in North America that uses their new Android Automotive-based infotainment system. What you find on the driver's side, you know, about the left-hand two-thirds of this is dedicated to driver information, so speedometer, turn signals, warning lights, that sort of thing. And then the rest of the left-hand side of the display is for the map, for the navigation map. And that's where it shows that. So you don't have to look down, you know, for your navigation prompts and things like that. It's all right there. You know, you can glance at it while you're still watching the road. And I think it works really well. Nicole and I both agreed on that. That part works really well. And then on the passenger side, there's no option for watching videos or anything like that on the passenger side of the screen. Like you have in some Jeeps and other vehicles. What you can put up there, you can either put up nothing at all if you want. You can leave it blank, which is fine. Or you can put up to three widgets up there with various information. So you can have your trip computer with your fuel economy and range and stuff. You can have a weather widget. You can have the media widget that shows what's playing right now. And because you've got a fairly large area and only three widgets, the good thing that they've done is that there's not a lot of information density there. It doesn't look cluttered. They've used nice big fonts that are very easy to read. And so you can glance over there, just glance really quick, see, oh, it's 62 degrees out. There's the song that's playing, whatever. And the reality is most of the time when you're driving, you forget that it's even there. So it's not distracting at all. So that's good, because what you don't want is another distraction over there. How do you control all this stuff? Well, there's also back in the more traditional place in the center stack, there is a touchscreen there. It's a 12-inch touchscreen. And so that sits down, and that's within your reach. So you got a bunch of physical controls on the center console. You got the usual Lincoln piano key for the controls for the shift. There's a big volume knob that looks like a BMW iDrive knob. When we first went to grab it, it's like, thought that it was like an iDrive knob for controlling what goes on the screens, but no, it's just a volume knob. It's just a big volume knob, and that's good. It's fine. And there's, some switches for drive modes and things like that. And then the touch screen, is where you can control what's playing. You get various other controls, including, sadly, the vent controls.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yes. So some year back when Tesla launched the Model 3, they did something really dumb, which a lot of people thought was really cool because it looks kind of cool. You look at the dashboard of a Tesla Model 3,
5 minutes.
Model Y, or now the S and the X. And the same, Rivian copied that for the R1. There's just like a slot in there right in the middle of the dash. There's no vents. There's nothing to grab to move around to direct the airflow. You do it all through the touchscreen in those cars. And somebody at Lincoln thought, hey, that's a cool idea. Let's do that.
That's what the kids love.
That's a really terrible idea. Because if you've driven a Rivian or you've driven a Tesla, and what the Lincoln folks tried to tell us was, when we complained about this, but how often do you actually move your vents?
Oh, and Lincoln.
It's like, do you guys drive your cars, on days when, perhaps it's, maybe the sun is blasting down on you from one side and you're on a road that's maybe not going straight. And, sometimes, going in a slightly different direction or you just want to change the airflow a little bit and you can just reach out and grab that little handle on your traditional vents and move it wherever you want. You can't do that in the new Nautilus. In the new Nautilus, across the bottom of that touchscreen, there's a strip of controls for the climate control. So you can adjust the temperature and fan speed and things like that. And, turn on the defogger and so on. And in the middle of that, and it took Nicole and I a while to find this. We were trying to figure out, because they showed it to us. The day before we had a demo of this, and they said, oh, and here's where you can control the vents. You can just drag the things and have the airflow wherever you want. And then we couldn't remember how to get back to that screen, and we're looking through the menus. Whoever was in the passenger side was looking through all the menus trying to find it, and we could not find it. And finally, when we got to the launch stop, we asked, how do you get to the vent control screen? That button right in the center bottom. You tap that, and then the vent control screen pops up. Okay. So the second part of the drive, when we were trying to do that, turns out that, when you drive and your arm is stretched out and, the road is not as smooth as a billiard table, your arm tends to move around, your hand tends to move around a little bit, and it's hard to hit touch targets. And if you're trying to drag the targets around on the screen to control whether you want the airflow directly on your face or just kind of over your shoulder, to get some cool air, but you don't want it blowing right on you, It is a royal pain in the neck to do that. It's a terrible design. Please, anybody, any designer, any engineer at an automaker that is considering using this approach, yes, it gives you a ever so slightly cleaner looking dashboard because you don't have those handles. You just have a slot there where the air flows through. It's still a stupid idea. It's a terrible human machine interface. Just give us the handles.
Bad.
Yeah. And then when I drove the Ranger this week, which we'll talk about next time, it has traditional vent controls. It was so nice to be able to just reach up and grab and direct it wherever I want. So there's that. From a functional standpoint, that's probably the single biggest issue we had with the Nautilus. The other thing that you might find interesting, the steering wheel has been kind of flattened out a little bit, so it's not a yoke. It goes all the way around, but it's sort of oval shaped. So the top and the bottom have been kind of squished. And that's so that when you're driving, the top part of the steering wheel gives you a free view of that screen that's right in front of you. That worked fine. If you are someone that drives with your hands in the 10 and 2 position, it's going to take you a couple of minutes to getting used to kind of the shape of the wheel. If you drive
nine and three,
yeah. If you drive 9 and 3, then you won't even notice it. It's not a problem.
The government changed it to 9 and 3 like 10, 15 years ago because of airbags.
Yep.
If you're 10 and 2, your hands will get smacked away when the airbag goes off. If it's 9 and 3, you're less likely to get your hand hurt yourself.
Yes.
You get hurt by the bag exploding. So 9 and 3, people, just like a race car driver.
Yep. Absolutely.
I know it's going to be hard. It's decades and decades of you doing 10 and 2, 9 and 3.
Let's see what else. The Nautilus is nice and roomy, lots of space inside for certainly for four adults to stretch out. If they're not too wide in the back seat, it's got the back seat can slide forward and back about 8 inches. So you can adjust, if you need more cargo space, you can move the seat forward a little bit, otherwise you can move it back and give just tons of rear leg room, very roomy. It drives fine. This is not a sports car. There's almost no steering feedback, unfortunately, but the ride quality was fine. It's comfortable. There's decent body control. It's as Lincolns tend to be, it's fairly quiet. My only other major complaint with the Nautilus was the pricing. It's a little expensive. At first, as a premium SUV, it didn't, when I looked at the pricing sheet, it didn't look that bad until I actually started comparing it against some other vehicles. So you can get the Nautilus with it all. New Nautiluses are all-wheel drive, so there's no front-wheel drive Nautilus anymore. They have three trim levels, the Premier, Reserve, and Black Label. You can get a 2-liter turbocharged four-cylinder, which if it was in a Ford vehicle, it would be badged as an EcoBoost, but it's not, so it's just a 2-liter turbocharged engine for Lincoln. They don't use the EcoBoost branding. 250 horsepower. It's a good engine. Plenty of performance. In fact, it actually feels kind of better than the optional engine, which is a hybrid. So for the first time, they're Ford their transverse engine vehicles. They're doing the hybrid powertrain with the same 2-liter turbocharged engine instead of a naturally aspirated engine. So you get it 310 horsepower. So you get 60 more horsepower than you do with the non-hybrid version. But because the hybrid uses an ECVT, it actually feels less lively. It does, even though you've got more power, it is a little bit heavier. It's about 150 pounds heavier. And the CVT just kind of seems to sap the life out of it. So it was actually more fun to drive the gas engine with less power than to drive the hybrid version. And during our drive, I mean, we were driving fairly rapidly. And so we were only seeing about 23 miles per gallon indicated. You know, it's rated at 27 combined. You know, once we have a chance to, you know, get one out of the press fleet and spend a little more time with it, we'll have a better idea of what the true fuel economy is. But, you know, it's not particularly impressive fuel economy for a hybrid. And the thing is, it's also kind of expensive. Like I said, the Premier starts at $50,415. But the Black Label, or even the Reserve, you know, the Black Label hybrid gets up into the mid 70s.
Why are they naming these things after booze like levels?
I don't know.
That seems ill-advised.
Yeah.
Like, well, we can get a whiskey. Oh, you know what we should do? We should name our car after whiskey.
The Nautilus Black Label starts at $74,250.
Think how much whiskey you could buy with that.
And you know, even the Reserve is $55,000. For that kind of money, you can buy a Volvo XC60, you know, for starting under $60,000. You can get a Volvo XC60 plug-in hybrid. You can get a BMW X5 plug-in hybrid, or you can get a Mercedes-Benz GLE plug-in hybrid. And the XC60 has the shortest range of the bunch at 36 miles of electric range. And the other two, the BMW and the Mercedes, are both over 40 miles of electric range now. I think the BMW is 48 miles of electric range now. So I find it really hard to recommend this car over the European equivalents with a plug-in hybrid powertrain, because it's just not a great value proposition.
And other news, Hormel had a bacon that was a Black Label apple cider.
But it
was
for a
limited
really?
Time, and it was during the it was last fall, so I don't think you can find it anymore. So booze, bacon, and I don't know if it was infused with booze or not. And then Lincoln vehicles. Such a weird decision.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the one that we were driving. Most of the time we were driving a Reserve hybrid, and, you know, we priced it out, you know, and it was just about $60,000, which, you know, is more expensive than the price of the plug-in hybrids from Europe. So
yeah,
it's
a tough sell.
Yeah, it is.
If you're like, yay, I only buy American cars, then all right, fine.
You know, if you're comparing this to like a Lexus RX or an Infiniti QX50, I think it's a better looking vehicle than either of those. There's a lot that I like about this vehicle over those vehicles. But you know, when you start pulling in those German and Swedish models, it's a lot tougher to make the case for this.
Yeah, it's tough with those cars look so nice. And then, I do like the way the Nautilus looks, to be.
Yeah, no, it's a great looking vehicle. But and then, you know, you got that whole thing with the vents, and that's, you know, kind of a deal breaker.
I move the vents so much because I want them on my hands, because I get like really cold hands, and then I don't want them on my hands. And
right.
And so like I'm taking them off my hands, and then I'm like moving them, and then I want it on my arm. Now I don't want it on my arm.
Well, this does have a heated steering wheel. So
that's good.
You could just turn on the heated steering wheel and leave the vents off your hands. So there's that.
But I do move the vents way more than I thought I did. And I didn't realize that until the first time I drove the Model 3. And I was just getting angry because I just didn't even bother. I'm like, I'll just be uncomfortable now.
Yeah. And the same is true in all the Rivians. The Rivians are all the same way, including the upcoming R2. They for some reason decided to copy this. And there's some Chinese brands that are also doing this. So it's just, it's a bad trend. Please just give us the handles.
If it's a cold morning, you get in and you just blast the heater. But initially the heater is cold.
Yeah.
Because it has to be warmed up. So I move the vents away from me.
Right.
And then as I feel the car warming up, then I move the vents back towards me.
Yeah.
So now I have to like do that in a screen And when I'm parked, yeah, fine. But now that I'm driving on my way to wherever my destination is and I have to move them back, I'm like, hold on. Instead of just like grabbing that little nib that's pointing out, you know, that's poking out from the vent, I have to go into a thing and find a thing and do the thing. Now slide. Oh, I hit a bump. Now it's like shooting up at this, at the roof.
So that's the new Lincoln Nautilus. Come get
I
one.
Think everyone knows how we feel now about the fence. We just want our climate controls to be buttons. That's what my
yes, buttons and just a little handle on the vent so I can move it exactly where I want.
Little physical thing.
You know the great thing about those manual vents? They work 100% of the time. They never fail.
Yeah,
they're easy to use. They never fail. I have never had one stop working on me. And I can imagine, you know, because you've got some kind of motor and some flaps back in somewhere in the dash, you know, because you're adding complexity here for no good reason. It's a more expensive system than just having the handles.
Which is so weird because Tesla, you know, doesn't have a dash cluster because it's too expensive.
Right.
You know, you know, design, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no, you did it because, but I think someone, probably the CEO of Tesla was like, you know, what would be cool is if you could do it with your fingers.
Yeah.
And then it'd be, and so instead of you getting a dash cluster, now you got to do this thing. Swipe and drag and whatnot in order to just get the vent where you want it. And then you probably like, oh, you got to figure out exactly where it goes. You know, hold on, let me do this. Looking away from the road. Just a bad scene all the way around.
But if you watch the video, they'll have the link in the show notes. You can see how that system actually works. Nicole and I recorded that out in California. All right. Next up, another hybrid. This time from Porsche. Porsche is launching a bunch of new vehicles this year. They've got a refreshed Taycan. They got a third generation Panamera. They got the new Macan. And they also have a mid-cycle update on the 911 that will, for the first time, include a hybrid.
Da, da, da. People are going to be so angry on Porsche forums right now. Oh, man.
Well, they don't have to buy the hybrid version.
You know, but they're going to be so angry. Oh, there's a Boxster near my house. Dark green for sale. I haven't stopped and looked at the price.
First-gen Boxster or second-gen?
Second-gen. I'm not going to look at it because I can't afford that.
Well, even if you can afford the car, the problem is the cost after you buy the car for parts and repairs.
I know.
That's where Porsches get crazy expensive.
Yeah. They're just so wonderful to drive. But I have my BRZ. I'll be happy. I'm happy.
Okay. So would you be happy with a hybrid 911?
Sure. You know, I still believe when the Taycan came out, every automaker went out and bought the Taycan, and then they saw what Porsche had done with the chassis control, with a large battery in a Porsche, and how they sort of defied most of the laws of physics with that vehicle. And they went, oh, man. And they went back to what they were doing with their car. And they went back to their chassis person, and they said, Bill or Sheila or whatever their name is, I need you to go out and drive that Porsche, and then I need you to come in and make what we have better.
Well, so even faster Taycan.
I know. So I am not concerned about the extra weight of a battery. I'm not concerned about the extra anything that Porsche adds into their vehicles because they have wizards working in the chassis department, as far as I can tell. Wizards.
And my guess is that when you can, because what they're doing is they're putting the electric motor on the front axle. Then you get the battery, and this one, knowing Porsche, probably will not be noticeably heavier or not significantly heavier than a regular gas powered all wheel drive 911.
Yeah. You won't even know.
Yeah.
That's the crazy part. It's smart that they put in the front because then every time you stop, you get that dive, you get that extra regen.
Yep.
You know why? Because they're Porsche. They know what they're doing.
I'm just surprised that it's taken Porsche this long to do a hybrid 911. You know, because they back in 2010, when I was still writing for Autoblog and other outlets, I covered the 911 GT3R hybrid, which was, you know, their hybrid GT3 race car that they ran in a bunch of races in 2010. It was a one-off. They ran it in the Nürburgring 24 Hours and some other races, and they brought it to the U.S. and ran it at Petit Le Mans. And I went there with Porsche and wrote about it for Popular Mechanics. And that one, you know, they had a similar setup with the electric motor on the front axle, but that one used the flywheel system that they later used, that Audi used on the R18 e-tron, LMP1 Le Mans car. And, I'm just surprised that they haven't done this sooner in production. You know, it's been 14 years since that car, but they're doing it now. It'll be available later this summer.
It's everyone settle down. It's going to be fine.
Yep.
That's I'm not in the forums. I just know how Porsche people can be. And God bless them for their insanity.
All right. Polestar. Polestar's got a couple of new cars launching in North America this year. They've still got the Polestar 2. The Polestar 3 is finally coming. It's in production now in China. And they have been doing pilot production in South Carolina at the Volvo factory there, where they also build the S90s and other stuff. And they'll be building the EX90 there. And the Polestar 3 will also be built there. Last year, they announced pricing for the Polestar 3. So this is a new two-row, crossover, electric crossover, 111 kilowatt-hour battery pack. Last year when they announced the pricing, it started at a little over $83,000. Now they have decided, that's too expensive. So we're chopping 10 grand off the price.
10 grand.
Yep.
It also puts all but the super fancy one underneath that $80,000 roof target. What's that word?
Threshold, ceiling.
Threshold. There we go. Ceiling. Thank you.
Yes.
Roof. The roof. Under the roof of the
for tax credits. Yes.
For tax credits. Yes.
So Polestar 3 deliveries are scheduled to start in the second quarter of this year. So that means sometime between April and June. The base model, with a mere 489 horsepower and 620 foot pounds of torque, starts at 73,400. That all of them now include the pilot pack. So with their pilot assist system as, standard, and then the it goes up from there. Add the plus pack to that base model, adds another $5,000 or $5,500, and then the performance pack cranks that up to $79,400, and then performance pack, pilot pack, and plus pack takes you up to $84,900.
I'm gonna say just get the entry level.
Because yeah,
the plus pack, you're like, oh, I get some extra ADAS stuff. Whoop-de-doo.
315 miles of range, 0-60 in 5 seconds. I mean, the performance pack only drops the 0-60 time from 5 to 4.7 seconds.
Ooh, 0.3 seconds. What are you doing?
Still plenty fast enough.
You don't need to go that fast anywhere.
Yeah.
In an SUV.
And Polestar has said that if you lease, you will get the $7,500 off on all Polestar 3s.
All versions.
Yep.
Wow. So there you go. You're going to get you're getting your Polestar fix in.
Yep.
For less money, if that's your jam.
All right. This past week, Marcello Gandini died at the age of 85. If you don't know his name, you almost certainly know the work he's done over the last 50 odd years. His resume, he was a designer. His resume includes vehicles like the original Lamborghini Countach, the Lamborghini Miura, Chisetta V16T, which was, that design was originally intended to be the Diablo. But Lamborghini decided, now we want to go a little different direction with it. So he sold it to somebody else, and they built this crazy V16 supercar, which I think about a dozen or so were actually built. The Lancia Stratos was another one of his amazing designs. He did a bunch of really incredible stuff. And he also did the E12 5 Series. So the original BMW 5 Series was
Gandini design. Yeah, the E12 5 Series looks fantastic. It's just a great, great looking vehicle. Every time I see one, I'm like, oh my gosh.
And he also did the Audi 50. My friend Brett Scott actually has one.
What?
He imported one several years ago, and he has one. It's pretty cool little car. It's based on the same platform as the first gen VW Polo.
Yeah, or you can just get the Rivian R2 because it's essentially that car. That's what the Audi 50 is, the R3.
Yeah, except the R3 is a lot bigger than the.
Well,
the Audi 50.
Everything's bigger. Yeah. It's like we're Texas now.
Exactly. Sad to see, but he had a good run. He did some amazing work over his life.
Just an incredible impact on the automotive world.
Yep.
Just at Lamborghini, just those two cars, the Countach and the Miura, just, oh my God. I mean, he introduced the world he created the supercar.
Yes. Essentially with the Miura.
Miura is the beginning of the supercar.
Yeah, I mean, it was gorgeous. It had a transverse mounted V12, which was just bonkers for the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's still one of the most beautiful cars ever built.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Should bring it back as an EV.
Yeah.
That's my thing for everything now. Just bring it back as an EV.
All right. Let's talk about data.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Last week, Cashmere Hill published a story in the New York Times about how the data from your cars is being used. And, you know, for a lot of people, you know, this was news. For those of us that have actually been paying attention, you know, it's actually not news. The first example she gives is about, the data, GM shares with LexisNexis, vehicle data. So if you have a vehicle that has any kind of telematics system in it, the automaker is collecting all kinds of data. Unless you have specifically turned it off, there's data being streamed from your car about where you go, how you drive, what you do. If it's an EV, how often you charge, where you charge. And it's used for, originally, it was mainly used, when GM first launched OnStar in 1996, it was, the main purpose of it was to provide some services to customers, like being able to remotely lock and unlock your car, get emergency service. If you got into a crash and airbags went off, it would automatically call 911 and send your location, things like that. And they've added all kinds of things to it over the years. In the last 10, 15 years, automakers have started collecting the data about how vehicles are used and feed it into their product planning process, how they design vehicles. It's like, what features are people actually using? How are they charging? For example, when Chevy did the second generation Volt, a lot of people asked, why it didn't have DC fast charging on it. And GM said, looked at the data about how people were using first generation Volts. 90% of Volt customers were just charging off of 120 volt outlets. They weren't even using a level 2 charger. They were just using a level 1, just a regular outlet. Given the size of the battery in the thing, it didn't make sense to do the extra cost of DC fast charging. And there's other features. We talked a couple of weeks ago about Ford, is going to be removing active park assist from their vehicles because people don't actually use it. It's a feature that they put in there, but almost nobody uses it. In recent years, they've also started sharing this data with insurance companies.
Well, sharing isn't the correct word. Selling is the correct word.
Well, Yes.
Sharing's like, oh, hey, we have this thing. It'd be nice if you also had it. Instead, like, hey, we have this information from drivers. They don't really know that we're sharing that we're sharing it with other people. By the way, give us money for the thing we're sharing, which is really selling.
Well, to be fair, customers do have to opt in for that data to be shared with
Yeah, but
insurance
they're not
companies.
told exactly what's happening for many of, especially the GM one. The GM,
Yeah.
how GM's been doing it is pretty shady. Like, if you
Yeah.
have to, like, well, if you go into this like huge T terms of service and find you'll find it, but
Yeah.
no one is going through the terms of service in their car. Hold on, hold on, sweetie. We can't go out tonight. I got to spend 3 hours reading the terms of service for me to share data with the automaker of the car that we just bought. Oh, it turns out they're also selling it.
Yeah. Well, I think it was probably about a decade ago that we started getting usage-based insurance plans. I think Progressive was the first company to do this, where they would offer you a dongle to plug into your OBD2 port in your
Yeah.
car. And, if you plug that in,
Metromile is sort of the big company now.
yeah. And there's a bunch of companies doing this now. And if you plug that in, they collect data, and they would give you discounts on your insurance premiums. Well, you had to know that sooner or later it was going to go the other way around. Yes, they'll start off, if you share the data, if you give them the data, they'll give you a discount on your insurance premiums based on how you drive. But sooner or later, it was bound to get to the point where, okay, you are riskier. Your driving habits are much more risky than average. So we're going to start charging you more for
Yeah, but that's
insurance.
Metro. You're telling people you've made it a commitment to these people where he's like, hey, give me your thing. I want to plug it in, and I know. Versus the GM, like, hey, we're just taking this information. You probably don't know you're sharing it. By the way, now your insurance is more expensive.
Yeah. Well, and I think we might have talked previously about Tesla. Tesla's got their own
Oh,
insurance
their
that
own
they
insurance.
offer.
Yeah.
And most car insurance, every 6 months you renew it. And they will adjust your premiums up or down based on your claims history and things like that. But they it's only once or twice a year that they adjust your premiums. With Tesla and now some other companies, they are adjusting your premiums almost in real time based on your driving behavior. Tesla will change your premiums from month to month, and not by a little bit, but by a lot.
Because you
And
decide you want to show your friends loose ludicrous mode.
yeah. Ludicrous mode, how fast will this thing break? How fast will it go around corners? All this stuff. And so if you do that, they're going to charge you more for insurance. Tesla gives you all these cool features. It's like, wow, look at the performance you're getting in when you buy our cars. Oh, and by the way, if you actually use that performance, we're going to charge you a lot more for your insurance. This is starting to happen with other manufacturers now too. Because the insurance companies have more data to feed into their risk models, and so they can do what should be m much more accurate risk models, for individual drivers, more tailored risk models, and give you, if you are a safe driver, then you should conceivably be, paying less for insurance. If you have risky driving behavior, you're going to pay more for it. And
I
it's
wonder if they've lowered anyone. Like, say you're a GM driver. You drive. You're careful. You don't slam on the gas. You don't slam on the brake. And then one day, whatever your insurance company, Farmers or whoever, it's like, hey, you're gonna save $200 a year on your thing. I wonder if that's happened, or if they're like, hey, he's a good driver. We don't need to adjust his stuff. He's fine.
The reality is, it's probably not, but
Yeah. You got an 18-year-old who's like drives like a 50-year-old. They're probably still not going to give little Jimmy good insurance rates.
If you're going to buy a new car, the reality is it's going to have connectivity built in. You can get it turned off. You can disable it. But that also means that, you're also going to be giving up a lot of potential features, like, especially if it's an EV, like being able to monitor your charging, Or find chargers, you know, get information about chargers while you're driving, while you're on a road trip, things like that. And so that's, you know, that's not great. But I think probably what needs to happen is, what definitely needs to happen is we need to have some data privacy laws in the US, which we don't have.
Yeah, and it's just willy-nilly give everything whatever they want.
Yeah, consumers need to have more control over what data is shared and with whom, rather than just, agreeing to one massive terms of service and, then they can do whatever they want with it.
Yeah, it's like all or nothing here.
Yeah.
And if you want nothing, sometimes you got to jump through a lot of hoops to do that.
Yeah, definitely.
Just ask everyone with a Roku TV right now.
Oh, yeah.
You got to write them a letter with everyone's name and like age. I feel like you should give the option of like, okay, I want you to have my data. It's fine if I share my data with you, but you're not allowed to share my data with third parties.
And technically you can do that. You can go to the automaker and you can say, I don't want to share data with third parties, but there may be some third parties that you do want to share data with, like charging companies, for example. And, so we need more control, more granularity over that.
Yeah.
Just something else to keep in mind. If you happen to have your phone in your car with you, don't forget your cell carrier knows everything you're doing too. They know how fast you're accelerating, how fast you're braking, where you're going.
We need better data control in the United States.
Yep. Absolutely. And cell carriers are absolutely selling your data to data brokers as well.
Oh yeah. Every time you're on the internet, data brokers, everything's data brokers now.
Yep.
That's the big money. Sorry, everybody. We all know everything. Well, they do.
speaking of selling stuff.
Whew, this all gets sad now for a little bit.
Audi, just recently launched the new A3. Apparently they've decided to, include, lots of hardware, lots of cool hardware in the vehicles, as standard equipment, to simplify their builds. But they are requiring people to pay for subscriptions for stuff that we used to pay for just one time.
You pay up front, you're good to go.
Yeah.
This is, and some of these things are so like dual zone climate control. What? That's either you have it or you don't. Adaptive cruise control. Come on, that's like your everyday high beam headlight assist. These are all everyday things that you use.
Yeah. If you want to use CarPlay or Android Auto, you'll have to pay to upgrade the entire infotainment system to unlock smartphone integration. We'll see how long this lasts.
Remember when BMW used to make you pay for Apple CarPlay?
Yeah.
And everyone just kept yelling at them for years and years and years. And then finally, they're like, fine.
And, this is for the European market. Apparently, Audi USA has said, they're going to do it a little bit differently. The upcoming A3 model in the US will leverage the same offer structure for function on demand as the previous 2024 model year. This functionality includes options, two specific features that are available specifically in the U.S. market. Enhanced navigation to enhance the full Audi navigation experience, which includes MMI and Audi Connect Prime, and adaptive cruise assist, which extends the capability of standard cruise control. It's just adaptive cruise control. Those are the only two things that Audi USA is planning to charge subscriptions for. Everything else, you pay for it once.
So one of them you can just do with your phone. The other one is like, if I'm driving a premium car, it doesn't have adaptive cruise control, I have to pay for that. I'm not going to be happy.
Yeah.
I either pay for it up front. I'm not. I don't want to give it. No. I just unsubscribed to a bunch of things recently.
Yeah.
On your iPhone, you can just go to the App Store, and it's like you could just click on, go to your profile and just click on subscriptions. It shows you all the things you're subscribing to, and I'm like, nope, 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 nope.
I do that on a regular basis, subscribe and unsubscribe to streaming services, depending on what's on.
Exactly. That's why streaming services are still better than cable. You ever try to cancel cable?
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, yeah. I want to watch a show that's on Showtime. I'm going to subscribe to it for a month or two, and then I'll unsubscribe.
Yep. Okay. Cybertruck. We haven't talked about Cybertruck yet today, so let's do that a little bit. Dan Edmonds, who's he's an engineer. He used to work at Edmonds.com, even though he's, despite his name, he was not related to the Edmonds family that started it and owns it. Now he's doing stuff for Car and Driver, and he does this really cool series on Car and Driver, among other things, of deep dives on suspension on new vehicles. And so, you know, he'll jack up the vehicles, you know, take off the wheels, you know, and these are all videos that he does. And, you know, shows you, you know, what's in there on the suspension, how it all works. And then he's got this ramp in his backyard that, like for various vehicles, he will drive them up the one wheel, one front wheel up the ramp to see how much articulation there is in the suspension, how much suspension travel there is, which is, you know, if you like to go off-roading, that's really important. You want to know how much wheel articulation you can get. So he finally got a chance to do this with the Cybertruck recently. Didn't turn out so well for the Cybertruck. He's got this formula that he does, you know, that looks at the wheelbase, how far up you can drive up the ramp, while keeping three wheels on the ground. And, you know, a couple of other things, and comes up with a score. And, compared to things like the Ford Bronco and the Jeep Wrangler and even the Rivian R1T, the Cybertruck did not score all that well. And one of the reasons why is the air spring suspension. And, you know, this is an interesting thing that people should be considering, you know, with air spring suspensions. Well, two things: air spring suspension and the fact that it's four-wheel independent suspension, as opposed to solid axles like you have on the Wrangler. The air springs are nice because you can inflate them, you can increase the ride height, you can get a lot more ground clearance. But when you do that, you're blowing up these big air bladders, and they get, you know what happens when you blow up a ball or inflate a ball, you know, and, you know, when it's soft or when it's, you know, really inflated to a high level, or you know, with a balloon, you know, it gets a lot more solid and it doesn't flex as much. And so you don't get as much springiness when you inflate those air springs. And so the wheels don't actually move as far. And so what he found was when he set the Cybertruck at its maximum ride height, it got about 30% less articulation than when he set it at medium ride height. So, you know, for stuff like the Wrangler and the Bronco that have just steel coil springs, you know, they can use their full travel all the time. But for air spring vehicles like this, doesn't quite work as well. So that's something to consider. You know, if you're looking for an off-road vehicle, you know, and, you know, some things like Range Rovers and so on that, you know, have a reputation for great off-road capability, those also typically have air springs, and which is also going to limit their capabilities. So you can have lots of ground clearance or lots of articulation, but not both.
Yeah, I like this. I haven't had a chance to watch the whole video, but I'm skimming through it. I like that he uses a calculator and a T-square, and I was like, yeah, this is the content that I crave.
This is a true nerd.
This is such in my, and so much in my wheelhouse, and I'm so happy that Car and Driver are doing these types of things, because, you know, you have this ability to, you know, the guy's an engineer. He knows what he's talking about. And when he, you know, as opposed, and when you have those sort of bona fides, and you can say, oh, by the way, let me get my calculator out. And he's doing the little calculations on video. And he has the T-square out, and he's all boop. And he's like, okay, now if you look at this. Now, it's a great explainer. And I think it just sort of shows, like, you know, I think for the most part, articulation for most people who are buying like a Range Rover or a Cybertruck or whatever. You're not going to really care. But if you're like one of those, like, I'm going to go like super hardcore off-roading, then yeah, it's a great point where you're like, well, you know what? Don't get that air suspension after all. Get this.
Well, unfortunately, the Cybertruck is only offered with air suspension. You can't get it with coil spring suspension.
Well, I mean, it's also not really an off-road vehicle. It's an off-road vehicle, like the Passport we just talked about is an off-road vehicle. Yeah, so you can go off-road. I mean, I can go off-road in my BRZ, if to be honest. but, you know, you're going to get more. I think for most people who are going to go off-road in the Cybertruck, you need to get over the rock.
Yeah.
That's what you need to do. And you're not rock crawling. You're just driving over rocks.
Yeah. And speaking of, it's a little more on off-roading with the Cybertruck, and if you do want to take your Cybertruck off-road, what you probably want to do is take off the tires that come from the factory, those really cool looking tires with the special molding on the side that fits with those wheel covers.
Yeah.
You don't want to use those off-road. And this is probably the real reason why we've seen a bunch of videos of Cybertrucks getting stuck doing off-road stuff. And it's because of those tires, to be fair, most manufacturers, for the tires that are equipped on their vehicles from the factory, those tires are usually in a lot of cases are not quite the same as the tires. And I think we talked about this with the guy from Tire Rack, the tires that are equipped on vehicles from the factory are typically customized in some way and are not the same as the ones you can buy as replacement tires in the aftermarket. In the case of the tires on the Cybertruck, they're Goodyear Wrangler Territory tires. one of the things that Tesla had Goodyear do was shave the tread depth by 4/32 of an inch, which is equivalent to several thousand miles of tire wear. And the reason they did this was because shallower tread depth, you get less squirm in those all-terrain tires. And so you get less rolling resistance and the truck gets a little more range, which is important for an EV. So what you're ending up with, with the stock tires, even though they are technically all-terrain tires, you have a lot less tread to work with. So they have a lot less grip, which is probably why we're seeing so many of these things getting stuck when they go in deep snow or mud or dirt, trying to climb up hills, because they just don't have the tires for traction. So if you are going to take your Cybertruck off-road, get rid of the tires that came from the factory and buy some proper off-road tires, with full tread depth.
And take those weird things off those tires.
Well, yeah, you should do that anyway because
they're eating into those. Yeah, just take those things off.
Yeah. All right. One last item about Tesla. Automotive News. Jamie Butters, who's the executive editor, Automotive News, published. He did his regular column the other day, and the topic of his column was that, one of these Automotive News does, they publish a lot of data, sales data and inventory data, things like that. Because a big part of their audience is dealers, and people who work at car companies, and, they classify, all the different brands. And up until now, Tesla has been classified as a luxury automaker, based, on the fact that they generally charged luxury prices for their cars, even though arguably they didn't have the same kind of luxury features that you found on, BMWs or Mercedes that were comparably priced. Automotive News is no longer going to classify Tesla as a luxury brand going forward, because based on their price cuts over the last year and their sales volumes, they're a mainstream brand now. They're not really a premium brand anymore.
Well, I mean, it made sense to call them a luxury brand when it just had the S and the X. Mm-hmm. And then the 3 came out, and it's like BMW decides to start putting out, Corollas or, a Prius or something. That's what the 3 and the Y are. It's a RAV4 and a Corolla.
Yep.
Or a Camry. Well, not even, well. You get inside of, no one's getting inside a Model Y and a Model 3 and be like, ooh, luxurious.
Yeah. They're mainstream products. And with the price cuts, 20%+ price cuts they had last year, they're not priced that far off of, a Camry or or a RAV4 in most cases.
Yeah. Yeah, it was weird that they were still being like their whole lineup was being, and the company at large is being referred to as a luxury brand. It's like, well, I mean, just because something's expensive doesn't make it luxury.
Yeah.
I mean, a saw can be really expensive. Doesn't make it a luxury product. I guess if it was like diamonds and stuff on it, maybe gold plating, diamond saws.
All right. And finally, Rivian. Somebody posted on Threads a little video taking their Rivian R1T and charging it up at a Tesla supercharger without a magic dock. So apparently Rivian has started, there's no official announcement from Rivian, although they did say when they did their R2, R3 event recently that they would have their supercharging support sometime in the month of March. Well, apparently owners are starting to get that update. And so it's now working. So if you have a Rivian and you can get your hands on an adapter, on a J3400 to CCS adapter, or you have a Magic Dock supercharger nearby, you can just go and plug it in and it should work.
Yeah, is it the same person? Yeah, they have a link to a2zevshop.com is where they got their adapter, if you're curious.
You might want to be careful with those with
weird third party
ones. Because they haven't necessarily been UL certified, they haven't been tested, don't know how safe they're going to be, and in most cases using some of these third party adapters, unless they've been certified by the charging station operator, they often will not work. You might get one of those and plug it in and it just won't even start charging because it hasn't been tested and verified that it's safe. When you're pumping hundreds of kilowatts through that adapter, you want something that's going to be safe. Don't get a cheap adapter just to save money. You don't want your vehicle to catch on fire.
Yeah, I don't see any UL stuff. Tom did test it, I guess.
Yeah, Tom tested the Electron one. Tom Malogny from State of Charge. He's tested the Electron, and I think the other one you mentioned, the A to Z.
Yeah.
He's tested both of those. So they are, I think they are safe, but we will probably start seeing some sketchy third party ones with, especially on Amazon. With random name brands that you've never heard of.
Yeah, because it's not UL certified because the UL 2252 hasn't been released yet.
Okay.
And then, the NACS information is out there from SAE.
Yeah.
But it's not officially a standard yet. The standard doesn't come until later this year. So there's that as well. So just FYI.
Okay.
But yeah.
All right. So that is it for this week. Hopefully Nicole will be feeling better next week. And we'll talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match. With Indeed, when I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.